Hello and welcome back to the Nowhere Office, wherever you are, with me, Julia Hobsbawm.
And me, Stefan Stern.
This is the podcast which looks at the world of work as it is, as it could be, should be, might be, with some of the leading thinkers and doers of the day. Hello again and welcome. We're rejoining our special series of programmes made in association with Prospect, the top British trade union for professional skilled workers. But before that, Stefan, how are you? How's work? I noticed you wrote a piece recently for The Guardian about the perk session, the end of office perks. Tell us about that.
Well, this, I suppose, is the chill wind of, you could call it, reality hitting, in particular the tech sector that perhaps had overexpanded and had also dished out some rather attractive sounding perks along the lines of food and leisure and so on in the office. But the perks are coming to an end, along with, you know, more importantly, the jobs. And it brings up that question of, what do you really care about at work? Is it, you know, a smoothie every morning, or is it actually being treated properly, training and development, and some sort of job security? So it's the perk session, the end of the perks. But of course, that isn't the only thing happening at work, and a lot of it is a good deal more serious than that. It's not about ping pong or free meals and so on. And that's what this episode is devoted to, fairness. And indeed, fairness, or the lack of it, was the driving force behind 90% of Prospect's public service membership recently voting for industrial action. Let's look at fairness at work, whether you're in an office, working from home, or, as we'll hear, working on a cruise ship or at Twitter.
We have quite a number of members who worked at Twitter who were impacted by the redundancies in Twitter. And what we saw there was actually quite scandalous behaviour. People really didn't get the opportunity to engage in consultation in the way that we would normally expect in the workplace. Consultation was over Zoom. Elected representatives didn't get the opportunity to meet with the people that they were representing. And in fact, the whole thing was a bit of a sham consultation. So clearly there are huge challenges in a situation where people are potentially going to be losing their jobs.
That was Philippa Childs, who's Deputy General Secretary of Prospect, distinguished trade union organiser, who's going to be joining us in a panel discussion about fairness at work with our first guest. And without further ado, let's hear Julia giving him his introduction.
Well, one of the remarkable features of this moment we call the Nowhere Office is how different everything feels in terms of how we handle work and what work looks like. But is it different? How different is work from how it was before, as in before COVID? Well, to give us some context, we're joined by a legendary figure in the world of work and specifically employment matters, John Hendy, Baron Hendy KC, Baron Hendy of Hayes and Harlington, to give him his full title.
Yes, John Hendy was once described as the barrister champion of the trade union movement and has several decades under his belt, lots of distinguished and important cases working with the NUN, National Union of Mine Workers, and the NUJ as well in the Leveson Inquiry. I think having the privilege of questioning Keith Rupert Murdoch Jr. himself.
Yes, that's true. Yeah, I did cross-examine Rupert Murdoch. Yeah, he didn't enjoy it very much.
Will that go down as a career? I mean, that must have been a very particular pleasure, John, let's be honest. You know, the representative of the man who brought us the whopping strikes. Did you give one for the team, as it were, when you interviewed him for Leveson?
Well, I mean, obviously, as a barrister, you're just doing a job. You're trying to put the case that your clients need putting. So that's what I did. But yeah, it was a personally a moment of sweet joy, I must say, yeah.
I mean, John, your career's lasted, I think I'm allowed to say, five decades. Certainly the transition from being a QC for several of those decades, a Queen's Council, now to a KC, King's Council. Give us a headline. What for you, if anything, has changed in the world of employment law and what passes your desk as really the preeminent employment law barrister in Britain?
I've done a lot of employment cases. You know, I started out doing a lot of injury cases, people injured or ill or who died because of their work. And then I moved on to doing a lot of employment cases, by which I mean cases originating from the relationship between the worker and the employer, unfair dismissal and discrimination and all that sort of thing. But over the last couple of decades or more, probably, I've specialised more in industrial relations and collective aspects of labour law, not exclusively, but largely. What has changed, I suppose, the obvious thing standing back from it is the change in the balance of power between workers and employers. When you look back to the 1970s, you know, 50 years ago, or getting on for 50 years ago, 3/4 of the workforce were unionized, and 85% of the workers had terms and conditions which were decided by negotiation between unions and employers, not necessarily their union, but, or even they might not have been in a union, but settled by agreement and negotiation. And nowadays, that percentage is certainly less than 1/4 of workers whose terms are settled by collective agreement. And when you think for the rest of them, I mean, most workers don't have any negotiating levers to pull. So their terms and conditions are set really by a unilateral diktat by employers. That's a fundamental change. And that's the reason why, you know, the recent statistics showing that we've got well over 1 million workers now on 0 hours contracts who don't know how many hours they're going to get in a week or how much pay they're going to get at the end of the week or even how many hours or how much pay they're going to get today or tomorrow, and the feeling of insecurity, and of course the issue which is uppermost in everybody's minds at the moment, the disparity between wage increases and the cost of living.
So the last Labour government brought in the Fairness at Work legislation rather carefully, perhaps not delivering as much as everyone in the movement wanted. We may be on the brink of another big political sea change, another Labour government with a rather notable KC barrister also at its helm. What are the straws in the wind? Do you think a Labour government, a new one, would be a bit braver than the last one in this territory, or is it still going to be steady as she goes?
Well, obviously, I can't speak for the Labour Party or Sir Keir and the people around him, so I don't know what they're privately thinking. But the fact is, and we, you know, I take them at their word, the Labour conference in 2021 adopted what they called a green paper, although it's printed in red, a strategy paper for the Labour Party called A New Deal for Working People. And that's an admirable document. It contains changes in all sorts of ways which will affect the balance of power at work. As long as they stick with that, that'll be a good result. I mean, it seems to me that there are really not many options, are there? I mean, the Labour Party can't just, assuming it comes to power at the next election, can't just carry on with the current Tory policies. I mean, that is not what the population want. That's quite clear when you look at the level of support currently for those who are taking industrial action. People want change, and they can see that there is insufficient power for workers at work to influence the terms and conditions on which they work and their pay.
There was an interesting piece in the Sunday Times about how the older millennial generation is really sympathetic to strikers because they feel the state's failing. And I wonder, John, whether you think that there really is a mood shift that we haven't actually seen since the decades in which the public became acutely aware of inequality and things not working very well. Is that your take? I don't want to put words or sentiments in your mouth.
Well, I think so. And I mean, it's not a sort of intellectual mood. People are actually feeling it in their wallets and their purses, aren't they? I mean, anybody who goes shopping now knows that they may not know that the latest statistic is that the price of food has increased by 16.6%, but they certainly know that it's increased and that they've got less money to pay for it. So, and people are panicking. There's no question. I mean, millions of people are thinking, what do we do? Cut down the heating or go have less to eat? I mean, and these are, you know, for sort of healthy adults living by themselves with a job, that may be sort of tolerable. But when you've got children, and they're now estimated to be 4 million children who don't have enough to eat on a regular basis in this country. I think you're right, the mood has changed and people are feeling angry. They're feeling powerless, and therefore they are supportive of those workers who are in a position to do something about it and are fighting to improve the situation.
One last question, John, because you remind me a bit of what I heard Gordon Brown saying the other evening at the Bevan Society lecture. He was also saying some of this deprivation, some of this real hardship that he hoped he wouldn't see in his constituents anymore is back, and he said it with real regret in his voice, as you can imagine. Is there a sense of two generations of Labour figures sort of coming back together in a way, this newer one, but also some of the experienced heads from the past needing to chip in and say, well, you know, something has got to change. You need a bit of gumption and courage to do it. Is that the sort of thing you're going to be looking to the next Labour government to deliver on?
Certainly looking to the next Labour government to deliver on, but I'm not sure I really share your sort of generational analysis. I mean, the pain is being felt by everybody from the age of 4 to the age of 84, and everybody is conscious of it. I mean, apart from the, my fellow members of the House of Lords on the Tory benches, everybody else in the country is only too aware of the problem that income is no longer meeting expenditure. So I think it's a very widespread intergenerational issue of which people are becoming very aware and are upset by.
Well, you're going to stay on and join our discussion in a minute, John, about the specific challenges of the digital moment we're happening. But for now, thanks very much for giving us your solo interview here on the Nowhere Office in cyberspace. John Hendy, Lord Hendy, Baron Hendy, KC, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
I mean, Stefan, talking to John Hendy is like talking to an encyclopedia of British employment law, isn't it? It's important that we don't lose this record of the last, well, several decades.
Yes, he brings a terrific perspective, but I was also struck with the way he sort of very politely put me in my place by saying it's not just new generation, it's not just old generation, it's a multi-generational moment. And it sounded full of vigour, actually, wanting to get stuck into the fight, but not saying it was just a question of the old guard coming back and sorting things out. He said this is a challenge for several generations of people at work and their representation and their legal advisors. So it sounds like we might see a bit more activity under the radar at the moment, but under a new government, it could be a rather more vigorous and energetic moment than perhaps we realise.
Yes, I think what strikes me about the world of employment and industrial relations barristers, and of course we've also spoken to Jamie Suskind, is that they aren't campaigners, but they have to campaign in the courtroom to uphold the law in quite a combative way. And not everybody's got an appetite for conflict and combat, even though they want change. And so I wonder whether, trade unionism and activism and use of the law is going to become more popular if there's a Labour government or not. What do you think?
Well, we'll see. I mean, I think the radicalising moment of economic constraint and the real fear that John was also referring to is, an incentive to action. And I think it has been quite surprising. Just, I don't know if we can say the strikes are all popular, but they're certainly not unpopular. And they're certainly not nearly as unpopular as I think the government were counting on them being, which has partly explained their lack of action and lack of political skill in handling the situation.
So, we asked John Hendy to stay on for a discussion about workplace unfairness as it is directly experienced, both by prospect members and elsewhere. Let's go straight back to that recording now, and to Stefan to begin.
Well, thanks so much to John there, and more is merrier. We're joined now in a panel with Philippa Childs, who is Deputy General Secretary of Prospect. Philippa, thanks so much for joining us in the Nowhere Office. The lockdown obviously had big implications for all workers, but technical workers, broadcasters, film, radio production, production carried on as far as possible. What impact did that have on your members who were probably being asked to work, you know, at some risk to themselves in this time of the virus? How did people adapt? And tell us some good stories and some, maybe some bad stories too about what happened to people.
Thanks, Stefan. As you said, I am Deputy General Secretary of Prospect and also head of BEC2. BEC2 and Prospect merged together in 2017, and BEC2 members work across the creative industries, including in broadcasting and film and TV production. So certainly broadcasting continued throughout the pandemic, and obviously all of us relied on that a great deal to entertain us and to keep us informed, and indeed to educate our children or to support teachers in educating our children. So broadcasting did pretty much continue, but only those people who were crucial to output to work, and lots of production went to home and stuff. So people were able to work from home in some cases. The vast majority of members working across the BBC and independent broadcasting did end up working from home, and in fact in many cases are still working from home, so the return to the office has been quite slow across the broadcasters. I think for our members in film, literally everything, film production, drama production, everything stopped at the time of the pandemic and didn't return until about July of 2020, and really that happened because there was really positive collaboration across film and TV industry to try to put in place return to work protocols that everyone was happy with. And I can happily say that during that time, there was a lot of collaboration with the union, because clearly if our members weren't happy about returning to production, then it wouldn't happen. So that was a positive, I would say, that there was through the pandemic in lots of spaces, actually, really good collaboration between employers, government and the union.
It's interesting, isn't it, that the whole question of health and safety actually almost got a new lease of life, and I don't mean well-being. John, you and I have discussed before the centrality of safety, the technical challenges of keeping workers safe, I mean, particularly in, say, broadcast environments like filming through a pandemic. What's your take on that, John?
Well, the government put out guidance to employers on how to deal with COVID. Good employers followed it, and employers where unions were strong probably followed it as well, but a lot of employers didn't follow it. And there were numerous instances of employers not taking the precautions that they should have done.
I mean, Philippa, I'm personally rather obsessed with ventilation and the emerging data that comes out of America. I've just contributed to a book of essays by architects and designers, all of which were obsessed with making safe the workspace. Is that a rising concern for you, whether or not people are expected to go into buildings that really have appallingly bad ventilation?
It's certainly a concern, I think, for our members. I guess it was quite interesting that particularly in film and TV production, bearing in mind the workforce is largely freelance and many thousands of them fell between the gaps from the two government schemes, then, you know, obviously people were keen to get back to work because they needed the income. But obviously there were, as there was across society, there was a whole range of views about safety and stuff. But actually, I think if I'm being positive about the industry, I would say that they have been very cautious, and some productions still, people still wear masks even today. So some people are happy about that, others perhaps less so. If I'm giving the industry credit for this, it probably is that they did adhere to the protocols that we agreed pretty well across the piece.
Now, this emerging digital world, how, Philippa, are your members experiencing this return to offices, if they're going back in, how are their rights being affected? But also let's hear from John as well after that about whether this sort of virtual, this sort of lack of tangible workplace permanence is sort of undermining rights in some possible way. But Philippa, first to you.
So I do think that the pandemic changed the dynamic around office working, and clearly a lot of people enjoyed working from home, or at least enjoyed the ability to be more flexible in terms of their their work-life balance and to have some time working at home. So I think that still exists, that people have strong feelings about whether they want to actually be in the office environment or whether they want to have a more hybrid arrangement in terms of going into the office. I think that the challenge, I guess, is about people's rights at work. And we have certainly seen some huge issues with, I don't know if you're aware, but we have quite a number of members who worked at Twitter who were impacted by the redundancies in Twitter. And what we saw there was actually quite scandalous behaviour. People were really didn't get the opportunity to engage in consultation in the way that we would normally expect in the workplace. Consultation was over Zoom. Elected representatives didn't get the opportunity to meet with the people that they were representing. And in fact, the whole thing was a bit of a sham consultation. So clearly there are huge challenges in a situation where people are potentially going to be losing their jobs and really are being treated as numbers rather than individuals with rights.
Yeah, John, that sounds a bit like a sort of digital version of what we saw at P&O, with also some messages on Zoom and a totally random and unplanned, unexpected devastation, really, of a workforce.
It wasn't unplanned. It had been planned for a very long time by the employer. And what they did was to ambush the workforce at 7 o'clock in the morning by informing them all that they were dismissed and no longer had their jobs. Those that were sleeping on the ferries, this is the company that operates the cross-channel ferries and one or two other routes, those that were sleeping on the ferries were given 15 minutes to get their possessions, put them in a plastic bag and get onto the quayside. And there they found that there were coaches full up with workers recruited by agencies outside the United Kingdom at much, much lower rates of pay, who were going to take their jobs. And of course, the effect of sacking them all meant that there was no possibility, even though they're well organized and represented by RMT, the Maritime Trade Union, and no possibility of organising industrial action, because you can't strike against an employer that's already sacked you, because there's no work there to go back to. So there were lots of other problems that resulted from that as well, but it was a demonstration of just how weak the workforce is at the present time. But there were just two other points I wanted to mention. One is that some employers have reacted to home working by increasing surveillance. And this is really, I think, a very difficult and dangerous area. Of course, they want to make sure that the workers are doing the work, but they should gauge that by the output rather than what the workers are actually doing from minute to minute or hour to hour. After all, using the worker's laptop to film in their home, in the privacy of their home, it seems to me to be a gross invasion of privacy, as is counting keystrokes on the computer and all that sort of thing. And just the third issue on home working I just wanted to mention is the question of health and safety. Because when people are at work, they have all the rights of electing safety representatives and safety committees and that sort of thing. And in the workplaces that Philippa was talking about, on film sets, for example, they have health and safety advisors whose job is nothing else than to make sure that the work is being done safely. Well, when you're working at home, you haven't got those resources behind you, and people are sitting for hours at a computer, not in an ergonomically designed chair, but on the kitchen chair at the kitchen table. And, you know, there's going to be an increase in back strain and wrist injuries and damage to eyes and all the rest of it.
Thank you. Look, last word to you, Philippa. How would you characterise the discussions within Prospect about how to both service your members and the issues, some of which you've both covered, and in fact, how you handle your own workplace issues? Because the point is everybody's united by the experience now. So what would you say are the couple or three unifying preoccupations?
It's interesting, isn't it? Because I am an optimist generally. And so whilst obviously post-pandemic, there are all sorts of challenges about the world of work and about organising workers going forward. Despite everything that we've talked about, you know, it making it harder to find people in their workplaces in the traditional ways that unions have, both Prospect and Bechtu have grown through the pandemic and post-pandemic. So we're obviously doing something right. And obviously we need to continue to think about how we reach potential members and what interests potential members and makes them want to join the union. And we're doing much more in a digital space as far as that's concerned. And then from our own perspective, so Prospect has moved to a sort of hybrid working arrangement. So we're in the office some days and also get the opportunity to work from home, which is also, you know, helpful because sometimes you just want to get your head down and write a piece of work or whatever. So I think that's generally been well appreciated by staff within Prospect. I definitely think that that's probably what the future looks like for unions. Obviously, the challenge is to make sure that we continue to reach those members, represent them well, and are talking about the sorts of issues. One thing I actually wanted to mention when John was talking about the challenges with working from home is obviously the right to disconnect, and we're all facing that challenge with more and more technology. It becomes difficult to switch off.
Well, Philippa, thank you so much for that contribution. We'll definitely give you permission to switch off and disconnect right now, but very good of you to join us, and John too, who's done a double shift in the Nowhere office, although not double bubble, I'm afraid, John. Thanks so much for joining us here in the Nowhere office and with Prospect.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, Stefan, it's interesting, isn't it? Here we all are comfortably Zooming and interviewing, but actually what this episode has really laid bare for me is that there are significant issues and complex matters arising from digital working, right?
Absolutely, because we bring the work home, we bring the job home, we bring that identity home or wherever else we are, not necessarily at home, on the road, in random locations. And that work filters into so much of our lives. So what John was saying about health and safety, conditions at home, the working hours, the right to disconnect, all these questions arise, and it's all part of making management perhaps a rather more complicated job than we might have realised.
I'm beginning to think Prospect, who have supported this program, may not in fact agree, but I'm beginning to wonder whether trade unions like Prospect aren't actually going to get involved in a sort of form of nudge theory post-pandemic, which is they are inviting organisations to realise that unless they enable different behaviours, they're going to get pushback, and they may end up going back to our first programme with the sort of conflict that everybody wants to avoid. Do you think that's optimistic, or do you think that there is a little bit of sort of psychology is coming into this piece more and more, isn't it?
I think there is something in that. And I think that also the practical reality of this still difficult labour market where highly skilled people are missing and needed and sought is that you've got to get the management of capable people right. You've got to create the right environment for them to do their good stuff, and that good people are not going to stick around if this job is injurious to health and peace of mind. So there's a self-interest for employers to listen to intelligent and constructive representatives who bring them the reality of the workforce to them very efficiently.
Well, we had a hunch that devoting some programs specifically to this aspect of work would work out. The listener will determine whether that's the case, but certainly I feel we've had a really rich three programmes. I'm still knocked out by the remarks that Hafsa Begum made about the, you know, the guts and plumbing of running a building from the ground up in this environment, and the wisdom of barristers John Hendy and Jamie Suskind, and the contributions we've had from Alison McGovern, who may well be in government dealing with employment matters, Adrian Wooldridge from Bloomberg, and of course just now Philippa Childs and indeed Sarah O'Connor. I think they've added a really rich texture, haven't they, Stefan?
Yes, that's right, Julie. It's been a very wide-ranging and rich set of discussions. We're teed up so nicely for us right at the outset by the boss, Mike Clancy, who predicted actually in a way in his discussion some of the things we were going to be talking about. Why don't we go now and listen to Andrew Pakes, his colleague, Deputy General Secretary, for a summing up of the situation.
Hello, both. Well, it's been another fascinating conversation in today's episode, hasn't it? I think really picking up on that issue of fairness and what it means in not just the old economy, but in this rapidly changing digital and technology world where Prospect has some emerging membership. What I think is really interesting to me is across all of these episodes we've done together, two real lessons stand out to me. Firstly, it's in public policy or politics, we don't talk about the nature of work enough. So in the old Mars bar advert, I always talk about work, rest and play. We often talk about one of the things, but not all three things together. Often work is lost in a numbers competition about are the unemployment figures up or down? And it's about who is in work rather than what is work and what is work like. And I think you've shone a light on that through all of these Nowhere Office podcasts. And I think the pandemic has really changed that concept of it isn't just getting up in the morning, doing your shift and coming home. There's a whole bigger conversation about what is work like? Where do we do it from? How do we fit our lives around it so we get that rest and play? And I think that's a really welcome discussion. I think there's lots of pressure points coming in now where the fog is descending from the old world again, and we've got to renegotiate the boundaries of this flexibility for all of us. But it's a profound change from the style of the work discussion we've seen in politics for the last few years. And I hope all politicians listen to this podcast because these are the questions we want to answer. And the second big theme is that, you know, work is already undergoing profound change and we all need to ensure we keep up with it. You know, 2/3 roughly of the 2033 workforce is already in work today. So it isn't just about training youngsters on coding or what the new jobs are. We've got this really huge societal challenge of how do we ensure people in work today can manage the change and balance from old skills to new skills? Where does digital technology fit into that? And how do those things fit together? So look, I'm in the Philippa Child's mold on this. I'm an optimist. I believe these are huge challenges, but as your show has shown and discussions have shown over this last period, there is an ability to influence it, but we've got to start doing it now rather than before the change already happens.
That was Andrew Pakes there giving a pretty comprehensive summing up of not just why we decided to do these programmes, but what the outcome was. Although I should say that this last programme was originally designed to throw a spotlight entirely on digital, wasn't it, Stefan? And we realised that it was about fairness and that fairness is old and new. I thought that was interesting, didn't you?
Yes, and that rounded picture. And I do love a good 1970s ad slogan. So work, rest and play. The other thing we're dealing with, of course, is martini, which is anytime, any place, anywhere. It's this combination of how we're going to make it work in the round, the rounded view, as Andrew also rightly said, not just the numbers, not just the data, which is important. The data is important, but the human experience and what it means in reality for people on the ground.
So on that note of fairness, and it is only fair to have a martini every now and then, I want to say that we've very much enjoyed working with Prospect on these programmes, haven't we, Stefan?
Yes, it's great to hear. Some of these voices aren't heard in the mainstream media as often as they should be. If someone goes on strike, they get coverage. But if they're solving things at work, if they're helping people at work, if managers and union leaders are solving problems, that's not a story in conventional news terms, although that's really what's going on in workplaces up and down the country all the time, learning and development and skills and progress. So, yeah, it makes a nice change to hear some of these conversations.
And actually, interestingly, a programme we've aired just before this was one with, you might think, is an incongruous juxtaposition, is Helen Brocklebank, the CEO of luxury trade body Walpole. But in fact, she talks about workers and working conditions and the psychology of the contemporary worker in a way that I think is very complementary to this programme. So do head, if you haven't done previously, to Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts and maybe dig around, certainly in the first two programmes that we've broadcast with Prospect, but perhaps others too. Well, that's it from us. No martinis. It's coffee for me. It's Monday morning as we record this. Thank you for listening to The Nowhere Office with me, Julia Hobsbawm.
And me, Stefan Stern.
It's a fully connected production. Music by Julian Brejean.
You can visit the Prospect website, prospect.org.uk, or we're at thenowhereoffice.com. You can find us both on Twitter. Twitter, and the next episode is in fact the last of this current series, so do tune in.